Hello and welcome. I'm Alex Sears and I'm at the Shakespeare's Globe today to talk to political playwright Trevor Griffiths, who I previously interviewed for Theatre Voice back in February 2006. This time we'll be talking about A New World, his highly successful play about the 18th century radical Tom Paine, which is currently on at the Globe, and about his 1975 classic, Comedians, a starry revival of which is opening at the Lyric Hammersmith next week. Welcome to Theatre Voice, Trevor Griffiths.
Thanks, Alex.
Let's start by looking at A New World. There's a story about this project. Could you let us know how it all began?
Yeah, I was working in South Wales on a miners' strike, trying to do a two-part film. And I got a call to say that Richard Attenborough wanted to talk to me about a possible film project. And when I spoke with him a few weeks later, he told me that he wanted, and had wanted since he was 20, to do a film or something about the life of Thomas Paine. And would I be interested? And I said yes, but I'm really busy on television and so on, and I would in any case need something like 6 months to make my mind up, which I took, and he gave me, and then we met and had a good old talk. I wrote everything I knew about Tom Paine on a napkin on the way down and by train, and we went through everything, and I said this is going to be a long project, not just in terms of how long it takes to write, but it's actually going to, the duration of the piece is likely to be long because we want to look at two revolutions. And he said absolutely. And
was the idea that it would be two films?
Yes. Yes. I said it's going to be the length of two films. Remember at the beginning of that decade, I had co-authored a piece, Rets, which was 3 hours and 20 minutes, I think.
About the Russian Revolution.
It had been 4 hours and had been got down to that in the edit, but we'd shot about 4 hours of it. So it wasn't such an unlikely thought that it would be two films' length. And when I did a first draft, it came out to about 5 hours or a bit more. And part of the task then, over 10 years of redrafting, and we went through four drafts between 1990 and 1999. Part of that job was to try and take it down and get it down to the length of one long film. And I think the fourth draft, 1999, was about, I mean, as far as you can guess it, estimate it, it was about 4 hours, like maybe a bit less than that.
And you published it, of course, under the title These Are the Times, from Tom Paine's phrase, I think, in The American Crisis, these are the times that try men's souls.
That was Dickie's.
Was it?
That title, okay. Yeah. I didn't really have a title, and it's strange for me not to have a title. Every play that I've written, I've had a title up front, you know, and I write to the title quite frequently. So I was never wholly happy with that title, but it was the best title we had. It was the only title we had. So, yes, I published it in when it seemed to me that we had passed the point 15 years in where a film was likely to be made from this material. And Dickie, with the kind of generosity that he's shown throughout the entire thing, said, well, look, I have no objection to publishing it. And he said, I think it's a text of such worth that it deserves to be published and needs to be published. But he had no strategy for it. I had a strategy. I thought that if I published it, then we could send it round as a book.
Yeah.
And indeed, it worked. We published it at the end of 2004, and by the middle of 2005, we had responses from Kurt Vonnegut and Tim what's his name?
Robbins.
Tim Robbins. From Mike Nichols, from Tom Stoppard, from Terry Eagleton. Some extraordinary luminaries of one sort or another had been given the opportunity to read the screenplay and had loved it and said so and were prepared to say so. Kurt was more than just pleasant and interesting about the book. He sent it round to everybody he knew in Hollywood and suggested that they make a priority of reading this book with a view to trying to get it funded. And that was invaluable. He sent it to Tim, for example.
Mm. And although it wasn't your idea, Tom Paine, is it fair to say that you gradually he got under your skin or you got into his skin?
He certainly got under my skin. You don't write for 18 years or whatever it was without...
So what appeals to you about Tom Paine, then?
He's a buried man.
Hmm.
He's, in Sheila's phrase, hidden from history to a large extent. I'm very interested in people, radical minds, hearts, spirits, who rise up like the rocket and fall like the stick, which is how Paine describes Reflections on the French Revolution by Bird. And I was interested to look for the reasons. When we talk blandly in an Eliotian way about the selective tradition, what do we mean by it? Who does the selecting?
Mm.
It's almost like the question, who shall be happy?
Yes, a title of one of your other plays.
Yeah. So there was that. And then there was the life of the writer interested me a lot.
Mm.
I've seen wonderful satires on the lives of writers or the processes of writers. One in Slave of Love, I don't know if you know that.
No, I don't. No.
One wonderful subversive Soviet movie about the making of a film in 1919 in white Russia, in a Russia that was controlled by the West.
Yeah.
And there is a writer who looks like a monkey and he sits on set typing
away
with his
like
hands
crazy.
Going up and down like a really bad actor. And his hair all over the place. It's wonderful, wonderful. Mm-hmm. And I thought, yeah, that's the writer. That is the writer in film, there's no question. You go to Hollywood and you see them, and they sit by their pools and they have limousines, but they're doing this. And they're nodding and smiling and hoping like hell that the check comes through. You know, it's tragic. It's tragic. Because some of them are very clever.
But would I be correct in thinking that Tom Paine was a member of the awkward squad? Is that what appeals to you? Because somehow he always went against the grain. That'd be right.
Well, I mean, that's to psychologise the character beyond where I'd like to take him. I see him as part of a rising class.
Okay.
That of craftspeople who really did have the project of the world in their minds. Mm. David Rittenhouse was the most important scientist in America in the 1780s and 90s. He's now known as David Under Rittenhouse because the part has shrunk and shrunk, but he's played with commendable zeal by Franklin was an awesome guy. I mean, Washington and Paine would frequently go out in the 1780s onto a mere or a river, and they would watch methane coming up. They didn't know it was methane, and they would try and catch it in bottles. They were scientists, all of them, and because there was no academy of science, they were free to be scientists, to think their way naturally through problems that were confronted by them. Yeah, it's an extraordinary century, the 18th century, and Paine was an extraordinary part of it. So it wasn't that he was awkward.
Let's talk about the staging, because you've got it down to 3 hours, but you added a lot of music. And could you talk us through that?
Yeah, there's a step between the book and the stage play, which is the radio play. And that required the first serious dramatic adaptation to get it down to 3 hours. And that was given at a time when I was busy with other things. That was given to a director who was going to adapt it as well and was a damp hand at this and so on. And actually, we found that he didn't really have time to do the work. And eventually, he terminated with the project and I took over. I didn't have time to do the work, and that's one of the reasons that I was not wholly happy with that radio version. Mm. But I had a stab at it, and I recognised once for all how bloody difficult now, because this was a rendered down version of something that had been much more extended.
Yeah.
So it already had a kind of density that made it difficult to trim.
Yeah. And Benjamin Franklin becomes more of a narrator.
Now, in the stage plan. Mm. But in the radio play, to some extent, he did, and his role was enlarged. Mm. But in the stage play, I needed two things to cut my way through the narrative of the piece, the story told. Mm. One was extending the role of Ben Franklin and taking him beyond April 1790 when he died. And there's a little joke.
That's a lovely moment in the play. Everyone laughs about that.
Where he tells us how that's happened and so on, you know. And I like that self-reflectivity of the guy. And if I had longer to do it, it took eight months to write that. But if I'd been at it longer, I would have done more of that, what people are now calling postmodern. But I've done it for a long time.
Yeah.
Making a narrator no more than he ought, or that the audience imagines he will. But that was one of the routes to shortening the piece, to taking a shorter run through the available narrative, historical narrative. The second was to tell part of the story in song. And I don't know how successful overall that was, but I enjoyed writing 10 or 12 lyrics.
The story falls naturally into these two halves, the American Revolution and the French Revolution. Could you talk us through the first one? Because Tom Paine, having done very little apart from earning his living, arrives in America, is appalled by slavery and some of the other injustices, and joins this kind of movement that gradually is throwing off the tyrannous rule of Britain.
Yeah. Well, I mean, all of that happened. I mean, he went out in 1774, a fit man, and was carried off the boat in a roll of flax, almost dead with typhus. I invent how he was saved from that by the fictional woman, young child that he meets on the journey, who's a really good character, and I love her.
Yes, she's wonderful.
She was dropped from the radio piece, so you can tell how dire I felt about that. But pretty well what happens in the play happened in life, though it's accelerated and condensed. He did spend quite a long time looking for gainful employ in Philadelphia. He was mightily taken by Philadelphia. He loved the market, the covered market, the first one in the whole of the continent. He liked the idea of a capital city. He'd lived briefly in London. It was the place of Franklin, who had first turned him on to America. Though Franklin was rarely there in these days. And what he didn't like ever was a side. He didn't lack courage, confidence, and confidence in his own ability. Somehow, he'd written one piece, and maybe a couple of short pieces, but one piece of length, which was the letter to the controller of excise about conditions and pay for excise men like himself. That was his job at the time. Interesting piece of writing, no question, but it didn't make him a writer.
Mm.
And when he met Franklin, who was a writer, among other things, many other things, and Franklin introduced him to Goldsmith, another writer, but not only a writer.
Yeah.
He saw that there was a job, rather as I did as a kid, coming through university and seeing that people actually had jobs as writers. I mean, they didn't clock in, but that's how they earned their bread, you know. Yeah. And I didn't know about that. I was completely new.
But it's also extraordinary that he writes Common Sense, which sold, I think, 100,000 copies in the first, I don't know, months.
150,000 by the end of the year, and it was published in the spring. So, so that's a whack.
For those days.
That's a whack.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a formidable machine selling it, though. We can over-romanticise what happened there. It wasn't like spontaneous reading took place. I mean, the Adamses up in Massachusetts, Jefferson and Washington down in Virginia, the crafts, the Carpenters Hall people, the Matlacks, the Rittenhouses, the Canons, they all had roots out to the people, to the people that mattered, the people he was writing from and to, because he was part of them.
Yeah.
The craftsmen of their age.
But it's also amazing, he wrote the first article advocating the abolition of slavery in the United States of America.
But I'm not sure about that.
Oh.
I'm not sure that he wrote the first article,
yeah.
but he wrote the most telling article in the period.
Yeah.
There was an anti-slavery movement in Pennsylvania, which he led in a way later on. And moved an anti-slavery clause in the new constitution in 1779 or 1780 when, and the play doesn't look at this, but he spent quite a lot of time in local politics.
Yeah.
I mean, regional politics.
Yeah.
Big enough, let's face it. But he does make a reference to it later in the second half of the play. You remember that she says, she's talking about sexual politics and he says, and she says, remember, you said we are upon experiments. Well, so are we. But I was creating I was trying to create a constitution for Philadelphia, for Pennsylvania at the time.
And then in the French Revolution, in the second half of the play, he comes across as a comparative moderate in that he voted against the death penalty for Louis XVI. And he obviously hated the idea of the terror. And he was imprisoned.
Yeah, I don't read him as moderate. I just read him as he'd reached the end of his understanding of what political revolution meant. Because he was already working on another notion, which was a revolution in the system of civilization. His argument being that once we had representative government, once the law had been instantiated and instated as the leader of the people, that would lead the people through the constitution, and thereafter we could take the crowns and crack them and throw them out and everybody got a piece of it. The people were sovereign, and it's a very neat idea. It's a beautiful idea on a page. It's a difficult idea to actually when the people who are looking for bits of the crown have been brutalised for centuries. Which, and Danton is very persuasive in that second half about just that. The Danton play, by the way, came out of this play. Tulvinda was in the Danton play, you'll remember, and last night we were going through the quotations that, that came from Tom Paine.
And he's now in the new production.
And he's now,
Comedians.
Exactly.
I just wanted to get back a bit on Tom Paine. He ends up in America, but hated because of his views about religion. And so once he was this great American hero of the Revolution, and then he fell out of favour. Is that right?
Well, loosely, but... He had become passé by the time he left America, and that was long before he wrote The Age of Reason. Well, not long before, but it was certainly before he wrote The Age of Reason and before he began tackling that very important ground to do with the existence of God, the power of churches, and so on, and of religion more generally. Mm. It's certain that when Age of Reason 1 and 2 and then 3 were published, the door was closed in America, because America had been always had a strong fundamental religious leadership, but it then became much more fundamentalist.
Yeah.
And I describe the people who meet him at the New York docks as the Ayatollahs of hate or something, you know, and the Ayatollahs of their day.
Mm.
America loves God is one of the things that we have. It's a nice moment, that, when he comes back.
And do you think this underlines his continued relevance? Because after all, we still have a monarchy here.
Mm-hmm.
We still have an aristocracy. We have bishops in the House of Lords. Is there
an established church? Yeah.
Yeah. All that unfinished business.
I think it does. But there is so much unfinished business from the French Revolution, let alone, and there is from the American Revolution. But the French Revolution took it over. I mean, took the revolutionary path single-handedly in 1789, and tried to set fire to the world and failed, and became ever more desperate in their application of terror and so on.
Yeah. But also because they were ever more threatened by other powers.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, that's the old argument that comes up again in Russia. When they're walled off and they can't get medical supplies and food through, then they have to take executive steps, and the economy has to be an iron economy and all the rest of it. It's an argument, it's a dialectic that swaps this way and that throughout the revolutionary history. But what interested Paine was okay, the record is very dark against the past rulers, but if we can take political power from these people, we can take all power from these people.
Yes.
And we can make a hegemony of people like us, which is like 80 or 90% of the people. But how to get and then we could outlaw excessive wealth and excessive poverty, and that basically is what Rights of Man 2 is about. It's about setting out how a state can look after its people as a responsibility and a duty. So there's going to be pensions at birth. There's going to be grants for education. Nobody will start their lives in poverty, and nobody will end their lives in poverty. That's an absolute conviction in Paine.
And we've been defending the welfare state, I don't know, ever since we were born.
Absolutely.
And that was his sort of idea.
Absolutely. Mm. And there is one hugely powerful and compelling statement by Paine somewhere, I think maybe in The Rights of Man 2, which is, hunger is not a postponable want. And at one level it's such a truism, it howls. And at another level, I've never thought of it like that, you know, since I was hungry as a kid. And that's what I call meaningful literature.
Also, what strikes me about Paine is his idealism and his holding to principle. And obviously that's something that we're perhaps missing today in politics.
Well, I mean, there's an argument for abandoning principle when principle doesn't work, or when it's no longer valid, or whatever, you know. But the grounds on which the principle of social justice are based are fairly well known and measurable. And those people who moved from, to take one sort of political movement from Labour to New Labour, did it in what they considered to be the knowledge that the world had changed utterly, and trade unions and trade union power was indefensible, and so on. I mean, that's a long, tight argument that we haven't got time for, but they then decided that everybody had a right to be greedy. That the new principle was scramble for everything you can get, because our leaders are doing it and they're telling us to do it as well. And by doing it, we're making everybody's life better. So they sleepwalked into a nonsense.
Yeah, and into our current crisis.
Yeah. So yes, I mean, there has been a lack of principle or an abandoning of principle too early. Mm. And some of my closest friends from the 70s are now people I wouldn't cross the street to say hello to. And they have to be pretty bad for that, because I'm a, it's by my reputation, I'm a decently equable person, you know. Mm. I enjoy embrace, I don't like challenge and clamour and stuff. Mm. But I'd willingly kneecap some of the bastards who are now holding down six-figure salaries in government.